Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. A new film released last month tells the story of a group of Mexican-American teen caddies who formed their school's first golf team in their border city's high school in the 1950s and took their team to state.
Now, these teams, they've had access to a lot of things you boys haven't, but the best golfer isn't the one with the fanciest clubs. It's the one who can summon the will to keep swinging.
The film The Long Game is based on a true story. Lupe Felan, Felipe Romero, Mario Lomas, Gene Vasquez, and Joe Trevino played on their own homemade greens on outdated and inferior equipment with no professional guidance. They caddied for wealthy white men at the local country club in Del Rio, Texas. Their talent was harnessed and honed by J.B. Peña, the superintendent of the San Felipe Independent School District, which served mostly Mexican-American students. Their on-screen story is told in The Long Game, helmed by Cuban-American director Julio Quintana. Their original story was published in the 2012 book Mustang Miracle by Humberto Garcia, a San Antonio lawyer, writer, and actor who was born and raised in the San Felipe area of Del Rio. Garcia joins us today to talk about the story of the San Felipe Mustangs, who took their team to the Texas State High School Golf Championship in 1957. Garcia explains the segregated dynamic of Del Rio at the time.
It was a segregated city, and the dividing line or boundary between what was considered San Felipe and then the Del Rio side was the San Felipe Creek. And we live southeast of the creek, and everything northwest was the white part of town. And I grew up in the brown part of town. I was actually born right next to the high school, the San Felipe High School. And then my parents moved and bought some property and built a little house next to the railroad tracks. We went to San Felipe schools.
And give us a time frame when this all happened.
I started pre-kindergarten in 1960 at 5 years old. Spanish had been my primary language, and then I learned English as I went through school and then attended all schools, except for one semester. In 1967, my parents decided to accept the invitation of my uncle and aunt to move to Iowa, and they told them that they would get a job there, and sure enough, we left right after school, ended in May of 67. And we got to see cousins that we hadn't seen in a while. My parents got jobs at the Lewis Rich Foods processing plant. And it was a great summer. And my parents were thinking seriously of making it a permanent move. And we all decided, yeah, let's do that. Because we really enjoyed the little city called West Liberty. We started school. I started the seventh grade until the first snowfall. Then we realized that it was not always nice and warm, and it got very, very cold, and we were not used to the cold, and my parents just said, you know, this is just not right for us. So in Thanksgiving weekend of 67, we moved back to Del Rio and then got back to starting school there.
So we've talked to some folks who were educators in Del Rio and San Felipe, in the San Felipe district when it was segregated, and they have talked to us about that segregation that they experienced. And it's a very common story you do hear across schools in Texas, not just along the border, but Latino students who are put in classes that are for Spanish speakers only, even though you may speak English as your primary language, or you're getting hand-me-down books, or you're being held back by a grade or two because it's assumed that you are not as smart as the white students. So I'm curious if you, when you were in school, experienced any of that.
Actually, not really. I experienced it a little bit when I was in Iowa because I was the only Mexican-American in my seventh grade class. During some conversations, some of the white kids would make it a point to point out the differences in between us. That made me uncomfortable. The English teacher gave us a picture and it was a picture of this black man sitting inside this room, and she told us, write a story about that. I guess she was trying to engage us in a conversation about race and race relations, because we all had different interpretations of what we saw in the picture. And I remember one comment from one white boy saying, well, yeah, we should let black kids in their school. I mean, after all, we allow Hubie to be in our class. Hubie was a reference to me. They call me Hubie. And so I felt uncomfortable with that comment, but I didn't have a real understanding and appreciation of the significance of it until much later. But in San Felipe, I didn't experience that. In fact, you could actually say that the fact that we were segregated from the primarily white schools was to our benefit, because we had people in San Felipe, teachers, administrators, that were all Mexican-American and that really cared about all the students. Even though we were limited in resources, they utilized every bit of what they had for the benefit of the students. And I think in large part that's why I was able to succeed, because of the attention, the caring, the nurturing of the teachers, because they related to us. They were part of us. And so they knew exactly what we were going through as kids and being migrant farm workers and all of that. So we had the benefit of their caring attitude all throughout the school. And I think that was largely a positive side.
Well, that's really interesting. That's something that I have read before, where integration actually almost seems to destroy the senses of community, where you have black or you have brown communities that are coming together. They're forming their own businesses. They're studying together. Like you said, the teachers are making that extra effort for you to succeed. So I think it's just interesting for people to hear that it is to the benefit oftentimes of a community.
Yeah, and it was demonstrated when we were consolidated. It was the summer right before my senior year when the two schools were consolidated under court order. And there was a big clash between students from both sides. Things were supposed to be a different school. The judge had ordered it. It's actually a different school, not one absorbing the other. But we felt like the powers that be were actually, their attitude was absorbing us, and they're going to be part of them. Mm-hmm. And that's not what we wanted, and that's not what was ordered. And we thought they were very slow in creating the new things, the new mascot, the new colors, the new songs. That was important to high school students. We thought that they weren't moving fast enough, so we ended up clashing, and there were fights, and it culminating in a big riot during the last pep rally. But then after that year ended, they adopted everything new. And now I see the difference. I go back and I've spoken to the graduating class a couple of years ago, and they're pretty much cohesive in the way they are attending school and being educated. Everybody's together, and there doesn't seem to be a split between the white students and the brown students. I was very impressed.
So what was it that made you take a look back at San Felipe High School, at its history, and discover the story of these Latino caddies who were carrying around golf clubs and cleaning shoes for some of the wealthier white patrons of this country club in Del Rio? And then how did you discover that they actually came together to be a success story?
Yeah, I'm ashamed to say that even though I came from that same high school, growing up and even through high school and several years later, I was not aware that we had a golf team in 1957 or that we won the state championship. Because the school no longer exists, the ex-students association is pretty strong, and they hold a reunion every 2 years. One of the activities that is part of the reunion is a golf tournament. The golf tournament is used to raise funds for scholarship money. In 2008, we had our golf tournament. Three of my classmates and I were in the team, and we participated in the golf tournament. When we were done, we went back to the student center for the post-tournament activities. The gentleman running the tournament got up and said, look, before we pass out the trophies and announce the winners, I want to introduce the members of the 1957 Mustang golf team that won the state championship. And we all look at each other and say, well, what? We had a golf team in 1957 and we won the state championship? Why didn't we know about that? And immediately the light bulb went on in my head and I said, this is it. I need to talk to the guys. I approached them afterwards and I asked them, I said, look, I'm fascinated by this story. Would you be willing to sit down with me and talk about it? I would like to write your story. And they all had a very skeptical look on their face. They said, are you sure you'd write it? I said, well, yes, of course. But why would you say that? I said, well, some lady tried to write it before and it never worked out. So I said, no, I'll do that. So I made arrangements with them to sit down and just talk and try to bring out details over the course of several hours and got the story.
Were they all still sort of based in South Texas, or had they sort of all gone their separate ways?
They had gone their separate ways. Two of them remained in Del Rio, Joe Trevino and Gene Vasquez. Lupe Felan ended up in California because he spent a career with the Marines. Mario Lomas was in Abilene working at a golf course, and Felipe Romero was in Missouri City outside of Houston. But they all were still, I guess, young enough and strong enough to still play golf, and they had participated in the tournament that year. And we ended up talking. I videotaped them and got all that information from them and then began writing.
Humberto Garcia is the author of the 2012 book Mustang Miracle, which tells the story of a group of Mexican-American high school students in the border city of Del Rio who formed their school's first golf team and beat all white teams in a state golf tournament in 1957. The book was made into the film The Long Game in theaters and streaming now. When we come back, the victory of the San Felipe Mustangs was a small but significant piece of U.S. history.
It may not have been something as significant as the Civil Rights Act or some other civil rights pioneers, but it was a little piece that helped break down that huge wall that we faced.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The new film, The Long Game, tells the story of the San Felipe High School golf team. The team was made up of Mexican-American teenagers who worked as caddies at the Del Rio Country Club to make some extra cash to help their families. Their district's superintendent, J.B. Peña, fine-tuned their ragtag talents to win a state golf tournament in 1957. It's a piece of Texas history that almost disappeared into the ether had it not been for Humberto Garcia. The San Antonio writer, lawyer, and golfing enthusiast discovered their story and dedicated himself to cementing the legacies of Lupe Felan, Felipe Romero, Mario Lomas, Gene Vasquez, and Joe Trevino.
When they were recruited, they were already working as caddies, and they already had developed a passion for the game. And initially, they weren't allowed to play on that course. But they were all determined. They all felt that sensation when they hit a good shot. If you're a golfer, then you know what I'm talking about. Once you start playing and you start hitting some good shots, you get hooked. And you just can't wait to get back on the golf course after the round. And that's how they were. But they were all poor growing up. And this was a way of generating some income to help the family and for themselves buy the necessary clothes for school and that type of thing. And in talking to them, they all will tell you the same thing. Golf kept them out of trouble. It would have been very easy for them, being poor, not having any real hope, to take the wrong path and start getting in trouble with the law. And they said, no, for us, we saw the kids that did get in trouble. And for us, this was our savior. And because of that, they were able to move on and graduate. One of them went to college, and the other ones had very good jobs thereafter. For them to see what they faced because of the poverty, because of the segregation, the discrimination, and for them to see that doesn't matter. We're still going to play. We're going to win. And they did. Was a small step, I think, in breaking down those barriers that existed because of racist attitudes in this country. It may not have been something as significant as the Civil Rights Act or some other civil rights pioneers, but it was a little piece that helped break down that huge wall that we faced.
Well, tell us about the man who brought the team together, the superintendent of the San Felipe District.
J.B. Pena was the superintendent, but he had a gentleman by the name of Hiram Valdez. Hiram was actually the one that prompted J.B. to consider organizing a golf team. Hiram was a civil service worker and had seen golfers in San Antonio and saw that kids in San Antonio were playing golf in high school, and so he felt that San Felipe should have a golf team of their own. And he and JB put together the idea and looked at the natural source of players at the time, and it was the caddies. It was the caddies who knew how to play and could form the team.
So you self-published this book, Mustang Miracle. How long did it take, and what did it take in order for sort of Hollywood to come knocking on your door? Because it's such a small but significant chapter in Texas history that we all wish movies would be made from.
Yeah.
So tell us about that story.
The reason I decided to go the self-publishing route is because from prior experience, I knew that it was going to take a while to find the right literary agent who believed that it was a story worth publishing. Then it would take time to find the right publisher that felt that it was a story worth telling the world. That would, in my experience, would take a year and a half to 2 years or more. I did not have the luxury of time on my side. The boys were already in their late 60s, early 70s. I couldn't wait. And fortunately, I had the resources at the time to just say, let's just publish it. And that's what I did. In working with the publisher, I went to Hollywood to make a pitch to different production companies. You spend 2 to 3 minutes with each publisher, tell them, all right, here's my story. This is why I think it's worth making into a movie. And they listen to you and maybe ask questions, and then you move on to the next one. It's like speed dating, you know. And I was fortunate that right off the bat, I got the first bite. One company decided, hey, we're very interested. We went and entered into a contract. And I met with the president of that production company in Hollywood a couple of months later. And she was all excited about the project and said, we're going to make this movie. It's a great story. As soon as we're done with the current project that we're working on, then we'll move on to yours and get it done. Well, unfortunately for them, when they finished that product and put it out, it bombed.
Oh.
The movie they were working on was just, I think it lasted 2 days in the theater and it got panned.
Wow.
And it was just not successful. They had Lionsgate behind them supporting that project, and they were going to support our project. But once they saw that movie was unsuccessful, Lionsgate pulled out. And this company said, we're not going to do it. They didn't exercise their option to extend it. And so that contract ran out. I'm spending some time making calls, sending inquiries, trying to find contacts in Hollywood that might be interested in making the movie. And I ended up finding one individual who said he used to work with Disney Pictures and had been participating in some of their productions. So he entered into an option contract with me. That didn't go anywhere.
I think this is a typical Hollywood story you're telling me right now.
Yeah. And it wasn't until an individual that had crossed paths with me back in 2002 that the project got off the ground. It was an individual that I had hired at the firm I was with at the time to be a clerk, a law clerk, while he was attending St. Mary's Law School. When he graduated, I convinced my partners to offer him an associate's position. And when I talked to him, I said, Javier, we really like your work. I think you'd be a great fit. We want to offer you an associate's position. First thing he told me, he says, thank you, but I'm not going to practice law. Well, what are you going to do? I asked. He said, I'm going to Hollywood. And this was in 2002. He left, and I had heard from a friend who knew his brother that he had been doing some small-time work. And, well, he called me in 2017 and wanted to know what's going on because he had heard about the story. And I told him, well, we're under the option contract with this guy until the end of June. And he asked me, does he have an option to extend? He does, but I don't know if he'll exercise that option. And by then, Javier had already set up a production company called Mucho Mas Media. He called me in July of 2017 and said, hey, did the guy renew? I said, no. So Mustang Miracle is available? I said, yes, it is. So let's talk. That's what it took. It took somebody that could really appreciate the project. Coming down from the valley and understanding Mexican-American history. He's a golfer himself, knows how difficult the game is, how challenging it is to be successful at it. He thought it was a great story and convinced his partners and investors to get behind the project, and it got off the ground. And everything looked like it was going in the right direction.
Uh-oh.
And everything was ready to go until COVID hit.
Ah.
And that set us back over a year. In December of 2021, he said, all right, ready to go. We're going to start filming in May or June of 2022. And, of course, I reminded him at that point, says, don't forget, we talked about a small part for me.
And?
Oh, yeah, that's right, of course. So let me talk to Julio, the director. And he said, well, Julio says you can have the role of the police chief. I said, that's fine. I just want to make a cameo in it. I said, sure. And then he called me back and he says, well, Julio wants for you to audition for it. I said, what? I thought I had this. He said, no, just go ahead and tape the lines and send me the video and I'll let him show. So I did, and he called me back and said, all right, Julio says you got the part. So we did. We filmed in Colombia in June of 2022 and then around Smithville the next month and finished shooting at the end of July of 2022.
Did you have any say in the casting of the film?
No. I didn't have editorial rights or veto rights of any type. Once I signed the option to them, they're the ones in control. As a courtesy, they did send me the first draft of the screenplay, asked for my comments, and then the second version, and then Julio's final version. They were all different, but what I was wanting to make sure is that the essence of the story was captured by their planned story. And it was in each of the screenplays they all did. And the third and final one was the one that created some different characters to match the story that Julio had in mind.
So do you think waiting that long, long time for it finally to be optioned and finally to be made into a film, do you think that maybe this was the right time to do it?
Yes, if you look at it, people say things happen for a reason, and I'm more a practical and logical, rational kind of thinker. But I have to agree to some extent with the people that say, yeah, this was the right moment. It happened for a reason. All those things that served as stumbling blocks along the way, it was somewhat of a fate. This was the right time to come out with a type of story like ours is, especially with the conditions or circumstances in this country as they are. And so I think we were fortunate that despite the fact that we had to wait all this time, that it finally made it through, and I was able to fulfill my promise to the boys that I would tell their story to the world if they let me.
And I think what is also really refreshing is that these actors who are in this film, and I'm talking sort of top to bottom, the actors, with the exception of Dennis Quaid, obviously, but you're not looking at actors who are in telenovelas who are very white-looking Latinos. These are brown-skinned actors. Yes. These are the people who look like they live in the area where they're filmed.
Yeah, they are. And all the boys that played the golfers, when they talked about working in the fields, and you look at them, you can believe that that's what we looked like when we were out working in the fields. And they all loved being able to be part of telling the story of our history. they had to learn the game. I think a couple of them had already been playing, but for the most part, the production company hired a professional golf instructor to give them lessons so that they could swing the ball and look like a golfer.
So did you have a chance to talk to any of the crew while you were on set filming your parts, or maybe while you were in talks with the director, of any sort of maybe self-discovery that many of these actors might have felt while they were maybe filming these parts? Because parts for Latinos who look like us, a little more dark-skinned, are kind of hard to come by, especially if they're not being stereotyped.
It's funny. They all came up to me and said, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for writing it. I don't know how else I could have gotten a part like this had this story not come out. A couple of them, this was their first major project. But I think they recognized that when offered the opportunity to be part of this project, they did not hesitate at all. This is part of our history. I want to be part of telling the story about what happened back in the 1950s. And they're all fascinated by it. And they all did a very good job of portraying the golfers and conveying that message that even when facing the odds against you, you can still achieve the impossible if you put in the effort, the hard work, and the dedication, and don't give up.
Have you kept in touch with any of the original golfers? Have they reached out to you about what they saw in the long game?
Yes. Unfortunately, Joe Trevino wasn't able to be with us in time to see. And that's one of my biggest regrets, that when he passed away in 2016, I hadn't been able to fulfill the promise to him. But then when we did film, two of them got to see it at South by Southwest. That's Felipe Romero and Gene Vasquez. And they were all very pleased with the outcome. Yes, it didn't really reflect a lot of the same details, reality. But the essence of the story was there, and the fact that their name was being thrown about in the movie and there was somebody playing them was very excited for them. Gene got to meet the young man who played his role and had a fascinating time on set. And then Gene passed away later in August following the South by Southwest premiere. Lupe Fellan got to see it in a special premiere in San Diego, and he was very pleased with it. So much so that he accepted an invitation to the White House when it screened. Regrettably, Mario Lomas was not able to see the movie before he passed away.
So again, this goes back to your comment when you first met them that we're running out of time.
Yes.
These are stories, again, that need to be told. There are so many other stories out there that are not getting told because there's not enough time.
Yeah. When going back to your question about this being the right time, yeah, it was the right time, but 16 years dedicated to this project had a lot of its frustration and disappointment. And the fact that I'm running out of time, and I ran out of time with Joe, I was running out of time with Mario, and with the rest of them, for me, it was frustrating. I had to become the most patient man in the world during that time. But I guess good things come to those who wait and be patient.
Humberto Garcia is a San Antonio attorney, writer, and actor. His 2012 book, Mustang Miracle, was made into the new film, The Long Game. The film and the book tell the story of the Mexican-American teens from the border city of Del Rio, Texas, who made up the San Felipe Mustangs golf team, took their team to state in 1957, and won. The film The Long Game was released in April under the production company Mucho Más Media, a multimedia company that supports Latinx stories, filmmakers, and talent. Check your local listings to see if it's still playing in a theater near you. It's also streaming on Apple TV, Google Play Movies, Amazon Prime, and Vudu. Thanks for joining us today for Fronteras. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Marian Navarro. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Hear past episodes at tpr.org and on the Fronteras podcast. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.